This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time is Phil Kirpin, Director of Policy at Americans for Prosperity, as well as at its organization Patients First, which is focused on the healthcare fight here in Washington right now. We want to get his thoughts on some of the latest political developments in the legislative wrangling process. And Phil, it's always great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Well, we're hearing several different rumors, the first of which is that Harry Reid is planning to bring to the Senate floor a bill with some form of public option. Some thought that that was dead on the Senate side. They couldn't get 60 votes. Do you believe he's likely to do that? And do you believe the 60 votes are there?
Well, what I've heard is that he's going to include a public option provision with a state opt-out, which would allow states not to participate in the public option if they so chose. This is supposed to be a political compromise to attract votes. In my view, it's really not much of a change from the original public option because all taxpayers are going to be forced to pick up the costs associated with the public option, implicit subsidy, if not even outright explicit subsidy. And therefore, it'll be very difficult politically for states to opt out of something that their citizens are forced to pay for anyway. And so I don't think it will change the lay of the land much in terms of getting to 60. I still think it'll be an uphill fight for him. A lot of the moderate, more centrist Democrats are very skeptical of this. So I think that Reid seems to think that the public anger has dissipated since August. I think that's a miscalculation.
Phil, based on what Reid's thinking right now, why would he come to the conclusion that tweaking the public option a little bit and allowing states to say yes or no to it would change the minds of whether senators think this is fundamentally a good idea?
Well, I think that he thinks that he can convince people like Olympia Snowe from Maine, people like Ben Nelson from Nebraska, that this moves enough from the original position that they can claim that they've got a compromise and save some face with their constituents. That's the theory anyway. I think that he's wrong. I expect that we will see a huge outpouring of public opposition as soon as there is actual legislation in the Senate, same as we saw with the House bill throughout August.
Talking with Phil Kirpin of Americans for Prosperity and Patients First. And Phil, another issue we're seeing back in the headlines is the issue of mandates, not the individual mandate, which folks are forced to buy health insurance or pay a relatively stiff penalty. But now the employer mandate wouldn't necessarily force employers at corporations employing more than 50 people to cover their workers. But if their employees aren't covered and they have to go to the government to get help, their employers would get severely penalized. What's the difference here?
It's not much of a difference, as you point out. In both cases, if you don't provide coverage, you're forced to pay a penalty. The question is how much that penalty will be. In some of the earlier versions, in the House version, it was a very substantial penalty. It has now been lessened somewhat. We're expecting that the Senate version is going to be $750 per worker, which is almost double what the amount was in the Senate Finance Committee framework. The Baucus framework was $400 per worker. It adds up. It could be substantial for some employers, and that could mean that they have to lay people off, which would be very unfortunate at a time when we already have nearly 10% unemployment.
Phil, where do we stand on the transparency issue? We know the Baucus bill, that committee voted down putting the bill online and giving people sufficient time to review it before a vote. What can we expect out of this closed-door session with Harry Reid, Max Baucus, Chris Dodd, and Rahm Emanuel, and some folks from the White House?
Well, I think that they have to make the bill public before they go ahead with a floor debate. And I expect that at some point, probably about a week from now, that bill will be made public along with a CBO score. And when it moves to the Senate floor, if they can get the 60 votes to begin debate on it, then we'll know at least what the starting vehicle is, but they're going to have weeks of amendments, most likely, a lot of debate on this. And I think it's really important that we keep that drumbeat up for the public to have an opportunity to review this before any final vote. And that means if they do have dozens of amendments, they need to get those all entered in there, submitted, figure out the final text, and give the American people at least 3 days, I would hope for more like a week or two, to really understand what's in this thing before they have a final vote. There are, I think, 8 or 9 Democratic senators who've requested that the final bill be made public for at least 3 days before they have a vote on it. So I'm hopeful we'll get at least 3 days and we'll be able to dig in there and figure out what's in this thing before they take a final vote.
That would seem fair, since this thing's likely to be more than 2,000 pages. It would take at least that long just to page through it and figure out what all the language means. Phil, another issue in the news today that could be a little bit damaging to Democratic efforts here is that different groups have now pointed out that anywhere from 17 to 25 million people, if the Baucus bill were to pass, still would be uninsured, which is, depending on your numbers, potentially more than half of those who are currently uninsured. What do you make of that? How significant is that?
Well, I think it's very significant. And the 25 million uninsured number was the official number from the Congressional Budget Office on the Baucus plan. You know, to spend almost $900 billion and at the end of 10 years, still have 25 million people uninsured, I think is an outrage. I don't think that the American people are willing to spend that kind of money and to accomplish that little. So I think they need to find some way to get that number somehow higher without increasing the cost, and that's a very difficult task. There was a Rasmussen poll out today that said that 57% of Americans think that costs will rise under health care reform, with only 18 believing they will fall. That was one of the key metrics that the president put out there to measure this plan. It doesn't seem that they've been able to meet that goal.
Phil, you mentioned a little while ago that you believe pretty much the attitude of Americans back in August is the way they still feel now. How do you sense that? There have been some polls suggesting a rising popularity for the public option, although not necessarily the overall plan, and perhaps due to costs, as you mentioned. How do you see public opinion right now?
Well, I think that poll, that much touted Washington Post poll, I think it asked it presented a false choice to people. It basically said, do you want government mandated, government forced insurance where all the profits go to these favored private companies, or would you prefer that there's also a government plan in the mix? And when you ask the question that way, yes, you get a higher percentage of people who say they'd rather have that government plan in the mix. But it's a fake question. It's a false question. We shouldn't have to choose between government forced insurance where all the profits go to private companies and a regime of government-run insurance. We should have the option of actually moving in a deregulatory direction, having real tax reform, giving people more choices, more control, and so on. So I think that poll was highly misleading. We still see huge energy. We've been going around the country with our Patients First bus, and everywhere we go, people tell us we don't want politicians and bureaucrats getting between patients and doctors. We want more choice, more control. We want medical liability reform, interstate competition. Those are the things that I think people really want to see. I just think they're a little fatigued after many months of fighting this, but I believe that so many people understand what the stakes are, that when we do have real legislative language before us, you'll see the American people rise up again the way they did in August.
Phil, last 30 seconds here. Tell listeners a little bit more about Patients First and how you're involved in trying to shape this legislation.
Well, Patients First is a project of Americans for Prosperity, and we're trying to make sure that patients, regular American citizens, have a seat at the table as this moves forward, because it's really been negotiated by special interests in big government and in big corporate interests. You'll see all these TV ads from the insurance companies and from the drug companies saying they support this because they think they can steer it to their benefit. And we want to make sure that patients are not lost in this, that patients have a voice in this discussion, and that we give more choices, more control to patients rather than less, that we cede it not just to government bureaucrats, but also to insurance company bureaucrats. They shouldn't be in charge of our health care. We should be. Our website is joinpatientsfirst.com. We've been doing events all over the country as well as posting regularly to that website, and we're hoping as many folks as possible will get involved in this effort.
Phil, unfortunately, we have to stop there. Thanks, as always, for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Phil Kirpin, Director of Policy at Americans for Prosperity and Patients First. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.